cool. All right, so good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I want to thank Freedom Road Socialist Organization for inviting me to speak and for putting this event together, so thank you. I also want to thank my USPCN fam, US Palestinian Community Network. And I also want to thank everybody who donated to my delegation fundraiser, whether you're in the room or online. Thank you so much. So, I'm just gonna talk a little bit about how I went on the delegation, and then I'm gonna talk about the organizations that we met down there in the US-Mexico border in Arizona. And then I'm gonna kind of dig deep into other stuff that we've learned over there. So I'm an organizer with the U.S. Palestinian Community Network, and we are really good friends with the Legalization for All Network. So then they were taking a trip down, and they wanted somebody to kind of bring the Palestinian connection to this, and so I was lucky to be that person to go down. We had a few people from Milwaukee, and the majority were from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I was the only one from Chicago. It was a four-day trip. We stayed in Tucson, Arizona. It's about an hour away from the border. We met with various groups and organizations that do different work at the border and at both sides of the border, in the U.S. border and Mexican side. On the first day, we visited the Center for Global Justice. It hosts around seven organizations, including No More Deaths. That's probably the most popular one. But it's also a very, very well-known cultural center and an activist and organizing center that's been there for decades. After that, we went to the 19th annual Cesar Chavez Holiday Rally. So it's led by the Cesar Chavez Holiday Coalition, and it's a coalition of groups who are trying to fight to have a Cesar Chavez holiday, state holiday, one day state holiday in Arizona. So they've been doing that for 19 years, and they haven't given them one yet. Through that, we learned a lot about Chicano history as well. On the second day, we split in three groups. Those who were able, who are documented and were able to go to Mexico, went to Mexico. Some people stayed back on the U.S. side and went to the desert and helped put water, jugs of water, with a group similar to No More Deaths. They're called the Good Samaritans. No More Deaths were really busy at that time. And as some of you know, there's a case now for one of their members who's been prosecuted by the government for providing water for people who need water who are crossing. And one more person who couldn't walk in the desert or couldn't go to Mexico, she went to a shelter. It's called the Inn Project, that hosts people who are waiting for their asylum cases, but after ICE approves their case, the Department of Homeland Security will say, yeah, we'll take your case, and then you're just gonna have to come back. But these people are migrants and they don't have nowhere to stay, so ICE usually just throws them on the street or drops them off at a church, and then somehow they get connected to this shelter, and then they go and they stay at that shelter. Yes, so on the third day, we went to Arivaca, Arizona. It's a highly militarized city. It's 10 miles north of the border. And it has a history of different right-wing militias patrolling, walking down the town with assault rifles. They want to protect this land from illegal aliens. After that, we went back to Tucson and we went to the court and we saw Operation Streamline. It's a program that I'll dig a little bit deeper in a little bit. And at night, we visited an organization called Mariposas Sin Fronteras, which translates to Butterflies Without Borders. They are a group that hosts LGBT people, migrants, and those who are waiting for their asylum case, right? Or they recently migrated and they're still trying to figure out, what to do here. So they host them and they provide a job for them and they teach them English, and it's a really, really great organization. And they told us some of the LGBT struggles, like being part of the caravan and just, immigrating, or, some trans people who are not provided, are forced to go to the bathrooms in detention centers, in to bathrooms that they don't want to go to, or they don't identify that way. So On the fourth day, it was an easier day. Only visited with one organization, which was the Arizona Palestine Solidarity Alliance. So that's kind of the highlight of what we did there and the people we met. I just want to kind of dig a little bit deeper of some of the things that we've learned. The first thing is I'm going to talk about is, like, why do people, like, migrate in the first place, right? What are the conditions that people are in that forces them to migrate, right? And so we got a lot of this information in Mexico when we crossed. I was one of the people who were lucky enough to cross to Mexico, and we went to a shelter called APOC, which is Home of Hope and Peace in English. And it's a shelter for women and children who are coming from various parts of the region, whether it's El Salvador, Honduras, other parts of Mexico, Guatemala, right? And it only hosts women and their children, and we got a chance to talk to them and hear their stories. And those women have all been denied entry at the border, or were waiting in the border for way too long. And the organization, APOC, they go and they connect with them and they bring them in, or through a church and different various organizations they connect them with. Every single woman, there was 12 of them, 12 or 13, and every single one of them told us their story. Every single one of them fled because of violence or the threat of violence against them or their own families. It's mostly state and cartel violence, and of course, domestic violence as well is present, and a lot of these, like, intertwine. But a lot of this violence that we hear about on the news has been created through decades through, like, U.S. foreign policy in the region. U.S. intervention in these countries, toppling democratically elected leadership or presidents, right, or installing U.S. right-wing puppets, and even, like, privatization of the, like, the social programs and the companies and stuff and the national resources, right? Privatizing them, or even, like, the U.S. companies and their, like, agent provocateurs, like, stealing land, right, and giving this land to U.S. companies who then, like, operate factories or farms with very, very cheap labor, right? And so if you combine, like, this, right, with law enforcement corruption and the lack of, like, sustainable, you know, social programs, the war on drugs and all that, it leads to poverty and inevitably leads to violence. Some of the women's stories, I'm going to just kind of give you just maybe two stories or three, but one woman was a judge, and there was a cartel in the town that she was in. I think it was El Salvador. They threatened, so there was a cartel leader in jail, and so other cartel members went in her house and said, if you don't release him, we will kidnap your daughter and we'll kill you, right? And she said, this is not in my power. I'm a judge, but I'm a different type of judge, right? I cannot just release this guy. I don't have that power. And they didn't believe her. And so the cartel leader started threatening her. He would send her messages to, you know, his people. And he said, once I'm out of prison, you know, you're going to be my wife, right? She's married and has a kid, right? And so she was just getting threats. And so she went and got her visa secretly. She didn't tell her mom or her husband. She didn't tell anyone. She just got her daughter and left, right? Because that was the only safe option. It was the only way to protect her daughter and herself. One woman was an activist. She was in Honduras, and she was an activist, and she was very outspoken. And a social justice organization made a video, and her face was in the video. It was the main face in the video. And after that, the Honduran military started harassing her and following her everywhere, right? And they would stop her, and they would check her car, or they'd give her a ticket for something that she didn't do. And then it just kept happening, and then she left. And you know, several other women have similar stories, and, you know, or have, like, their husband was, like, forced to join the cartel, or their husband is part of the cartel, right? And so the only way for them was to leave. And so the route that they take, so they, all of them have taken multiple routes to you know, migrate. Some have taken buses for miles and miles, and some have taken trains. And so usually the process is you take, like, a train, then you transfer to a bus, and then you join the caravan, and then you walk, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles. But the first step, most of them, the first step for them before leaving was hiding the fact that they're leaving. Like, they would keep it secret, and they would not tell anybody that they're leaving, just to protect themselves and the people that they're traveling with. And so once they get to the border, several things can happen, right? So you could be denied entry, which is the more likely to happen. Some are told to wait, and I'm sure that some of you have seen some pictures of like people waiting at the border in mass numbers, and some of them are let inside. And those who are let inside, some of them, if they get their, like, if they say, okay, fine, we'll give your asylum case a shot, and we'll hear your case, they either put them in jail or they just let them out. And a lot of times they just throw them on the streets, and that's how they end up in, like, you know, different shelters that I've spoken about. So I want to talk about, like, the closing of the border or this idea of, like, building a wall or having a strict, you know, immigration policy. And those things happen for mainly, like, three reasons, right? The first reason is the control of the flow of labor. And so when the economy was doing much better back in the day, the U.S. had less stricter immigration policy, and they were letting more people in. And even, like, the companies and even those who are, like, anti-immigration now, like, were pro-immigration and would advocate for immigrants, you know, in Washington, D.C. But now that the economy is not doing very well and companies are, like, outsourcing instead of, like, bringing in people, you know, they're just, like, the people who are trying to immigrate, they're treated as subhuman and they're not good enough to come in here. And so that's why a lot of people are denied. The second reason is money. And so militarizing the border, it brings money to those private companies that militarize the border, right? The U.S., you know, signs a lot of contracts every year with different companies that profit off, you know, militarizing the border. And so even those companies, they're private companies and private prisons and stuff, they lobby a lot for militarizing the border. And so they benefit. And of course, the politicians that these people lobby for, they also benefit. It's a cycle. And also, a strict immigration narrative, the third reason, like, strict immigration narrative out there, it wins, you know, sometimes it can win election for you if your base is, like, right-wing, you know, Republican, you know, like, xenophobic, racist, right? But that's really scapegoats with the real economic problems, right, that are happening in this country. And so the idea that immigrants are taking our jobs, you know, that's bull. You know, that's not true. The reason is because companies are, you know, outsourcing their jobs and their factories outside of this country, you know, but also a lot of, you know, humans are a lot of, like, human workers are being replaced by, like, you know, like, for example, McDonald's, right? They have, like, computers instead of, like, workers there. The wall actually serves to one goal, and the goal isn't to, like, completely prevent people from coming in, right? What it does is it makes it harder for people to come in the United States. It makes the migration route a lot more dangerous and deadly. And so, I mean, I've seen it with my own eyes. Parts of the border was open, like, you know, there's a siege and barbed wire, but if you look a few miles down, you could see it open and you could just cross. But if you cross, that means that, you know, you're gonna have to go, you can't just, like, go to the street. Like, there's going to be, like, border patrol and stuff like that, right? So this program is called Prevention Through Deterrence. It was actually started under Clinton administration in the 90s, right? And they shut down the most popular modes of, like, unauthorized entry, right? So if a lot of people migrate from this route, we're going to close it, but we're going to open up right there where it's only, like, the desert, right? Or it's really very highly militarized. And so people still have to migrate because if they can't go back, right? They can't go back to where they left their hometowns, right? Because they're still in danger there. And so they try to go through the desert, and it's a lot more deadlier there because it's, you know, miles, hundreds of miles of desert. And so people constantly die or get injured, right? And since that program was put in place in the 90s, again, through the, you know, in the Clinton administration, 7,000 people have been found dead in the desert. Our group that went through the desert, they actually saw at some point, they saw a lot of crosses, the crosses that resemble, like, someone died here, but they also saw human remains and human bones. And that's everyday reality, right? And Border Patrol have done nothing to, or the U.S. government have done nothing to prevent any of this. So this kind of brings me to Operation Streamline now. So if you go in the desert, if you're lucky enough to survive, and even luckier enough to make it to an urban area and just, you know, be able to hide or find shelter, if you're not dead, they catch you, right? Border Patrol catch you, and they put you in a detention center. So Operation Streamline is this program that mass deports people who've been caught crossing the desert. And so I just want to talk about what I, as soon as we got into court, we saw this happen right in front of us. And I just want to talk about my experience and what I first saw. The first thing you see, people come in shackles. They're tied in, you know, their wrists, their waist, and their feet, and their ankles, right? It's almost like they're war criminals, you know? They're wearing, I noticed that they were all wearing, like, regular clothes and not, like, detention clothes. And afterwards, we spoke to a public defender, and I asked her, why do they have their clothes? And she said, well, they haven't changed since they got there. And some of them have been there since, so we're there in April, some of them have been there since December, right? I also asked her, so does that mean, you know, do they get their chance to shower? And she said, no. So they're put in detention centers that were built to only host anybody for a few hours. They're supposed to be temporary daytime detention centers, right? They put the people there for months. They feed them like microwave like burritos and like a small like orange juice twice a day or three times a day, right? It's very, very inhumane. So once they line up in tens, right, they're in the shackles. They already spoken to the lawyers, and they already all, most of them agreed to a plea deal. And the plea deal is they plead guilty to crossing the United States illegally, right, unauthorized, and, you know, so they get a sentence from the judge. So the sentence is usually immediate deportation or some jail time, and the jail time goes from 30 days to 180 days. So even though some of them have done 3 months, right, in this detention center, they still have to do, you know, a lot more, you know, up to 180 days. So one thing that I will never, ever forget and that stuck with me was, a few people actually asked the judge to speak, and the judge says, go ahead, and the judge and then they told the judge in Spanish, and somebody had to translate. They told the judge, please, judge, we cannot go back to where we came from. You know, we are facing deaths, right? A woman said, if I go back, my ex-boyfriend is going to kill me. And then one guy said, I remember he said, I cannot go back because the Honduran military will prosecute me and will kill me. And I want to stay here. The judge responded by saying, thank you, we'll leave that in the notes. Case closed. That's it. There's nothing else that the judge can do. This court is a criminal court. It's not an immigration court. They should be tried under, you know, in an immigration court, but that hasn't been the case. And so, the Border Patrol and Department of Homeland Security have been using this loophole in a law that's been put in place in the 1920s, and it's a federal law. So the only way that it changes and stop this program is through federal action. And so there hasn't really been much federal activity around it. And only there's been some local, but they haven't really got their voice heard outside of Arizona. So it's not stopping anytime soon. And that was the sick part. And then so we watched the whole session, and in the whole session, 75 people got sentenced and deported on the spot. So, yeah, so the reason why also, like, the people inside haven't really spoken much about it, because they make a lot of money off of this. They get a specific budget just for this program. And so the judge is happy with it. The prosecutors are happy with it, you know, and the court staff are happy with it. They're okay because they're getting money paid, right? But the biggest beneficiary of this program is the private prison that hosts these people in. the private prison get $10 million a month from the government to host people, to host the detainees there, right? And they provide them with you know, not necessary items to survive and live, right? So yeah, that was, you know, that was one of the, that in Mexico, the hardest, that was the hardest, two hardest things for us to definitely witness and see and you know, to talk to people. Arivaca, I want to talk about that. So Arivaca is on the side, is on the, in the U.S. side. It's about 10 miles north of the border. It's a very, very highly militarized town. So going to Arivaca from Tucson, we had to go through two checkpoints, very similar to the checkpoints I witnessed when I was a kid in Palestine. You know, it was just like a flashback to me. In Arivaca, we met with an organization called People Helping People, and they told us how, you know, how highly militarized it is, and they told a story, and they told us that it's also, like, Arivaca and the area around it has been a testing ground for surveillance weapons. And they told us a story about how some right-wing militias who invaded that town patrolled it because they wanted to protect it from aliens, right? And they invaded a man's house and killed him and his daughter. This was in 2009. And so now with, you know, the rise of, you know, like fascism and right, you know, right-wing administration in office, the MAGA militias is what they're called now. They have been empowered again to go back to Arivaca and try to, you know, patrol it from any, you know, quote-unquote invading people, right? That's what they say. And the Border Patrol and the police, they use that as an excuse to bring more Border Patrol to that town, right? But the people of the town said, no, we don't want you. We don't want the MAGA militias. We're okay here. We'll take care of ourselves, right? But Border Patrol, Customs and Border Patrol, are they keep using that as an excuse. So what they do is very, like, is very tricky. So they bring rookie like first year or second year patrol officers to this town, right? And they keep them, they give them a car loan, and they give them a place to stay, and they get to be there alone, right, the entire day and night. And they keep the Border Patrol officer there for only 3 weeks to prevent that this Border Patrol officer will somehow make connections with the town, make friends with the people in the town. They don't want them to be attached to the people there or attached to the land, right? They just want to keep them, you know, keep the fear instilled in them. And so it's been deadly because when you just, you know, keep cycling the officers, you know, they don't really know anything about the town, and so they usually act more aggressive, right? What they do is they brainwash them so much, and they tell them all this, like, scary stuff, right? Quote-unquote, like, invading criminals and aliens, and you have to be careful. And they give them this car, and they give them this assault rifle, and they put them in the middle of the desert on their own, right? And then they're scared now because they brainwashed about people invading, right? And so they get very, very scared, and now they're all on their own, so they have to protect themselves. And the first thing they try to do is shoot, right? Shoot somebody and then ask questions later. A lot of the companies that make these surveillance systems are the same companies that make surveillance systems and like, you know, walls and stuff like that in Israel. The same companies. So in Arivaca, Boeing had a contract, right? Boeing supplies a lot of weapons to Israel as well. Their contract failed. And then now Elbit System, which is an Israeli company, they have a contract to build surveillance towers, right? And the surveillance towers have a history of like failing, right? You know, they put motion sensors on the ground to every time somebody steps on it, you know, they send a location and there's a camera that tries to track it. But every time they get an alarm by someone, you know, stepping on it, it's usually like a cow or a horse from nearby, like, farms, right? And so they're just, like, have this system for no good reason. And again, I just want to repeat. So I'm almost at the end of my talk, and I just want to reiterate what I said earlier, that, like, the U.S. government and U.S. foreign policy are the main reason to why people migrate, right? And it all started back when U.S. stole the land of Aslan, which Chicanos call the current land that U.S. stole from Mexico, called Aztlan. And then it got a lot worse after the U.S. intervention in the region in the 19th century. And now it's the reason why thousands of people have been found dead in the desert, right? And or either been detained or separated from their families. And I was really, really, really nervous. I was probably the most nervous person going to the border there. It was nervous driving down the streets of like Tucson because like, you know, I would see like border patrol officers and they just remind me of like Israeli soldiers patrolling like my neighborhood back home in Palestine. And I've been in the United States for 13 years. I have never seen anything resembling Palestine and how militarized it is, right? As much as Tucson and Nogales and the border. So the border, I'm gonna show you a picture in a little bit, but the barbed wire and the fences all remind me of the where I used to live. So where I lived on a mountain in Palestine, and the mountain behind me belonged to people from my hometown. They like the land, right? And the Israelis came and forcibly took it, and then they built a Jewish-only road that we were not allowed to, you know, drive on. And then they also put this like barbed wire that prevented us or farmers or anybody else from crossing. And it looked just like the construction of it looked very similar. The roads looked very similar. The barbed wire, everything. And so it was really, really like kind of traumatizing for me. But it just reminds me that like we have to keep fighting together. And that's the only way, like, we can, stop all the injustices, right? If we, because our enemy is the same. And then the enemy in the Arab world, Israel, is doing the same thing that the U.S. government is doing here, right, at the border. And it's the same companies profiting off of it. They use the same racist rhetoric, right, to justify their killings and detention and all that. And so what I gotta say is that like we have to keep fighting U.S. imperialism on all fronts, right? We gotta resist ICE and DHS, and we have to keep asking the impossible from our elected officials, right? And who like have done, to be honest, nothing, right? The Democratic Party have done nothing to resist Trump, right? People are still every day, every other day, we hear a story about somebody dying in detention, right? And that's just the stories that we hear about, and not the hundreds other that die in the desert, right? That we don't hear about, or we don't hear the stories of what happens inside the detention center. And so our enemy is the one and the same, and we have to build a united front to fight these systematic injustices, to eliminate all of this here and in Palestine. Thank you. I just wanna... So I'm just gonna run through the photos real quickly. I won't take that long. So,
you want this?
Just gonna kind of run through it in order. So this was the Cesar Chavez rally.
Oh.
Yep. This is a woman from the movement who is running for mayor of Tucson. So, right here, her last name is Romero. There are elections in November, I think. Oh, okay. This is another one in the rally of the delegates chanting. This was at the Global Justice Center. Sorry? Oh, no, but the center was called the Center for Global Justice. Yeah, and then they had that organization, I think, inside. So this is right here. This is Nogales, and it's split in half. So this side is the U.S. side, and this is the Mexican side. And so this is the border wall right here, cutting... literally destroying this town in half. And another look right here. As you can see, the two towns right here, and then this cuts it in half. So the U.S. side of the border was really ugly. The Mexican side had a lot of like art and memorials, and it reminded me a lot of like the Israeli apartheid wall and how Palestinians have used it to, you know, express political messages and stuff like that. So this is what you can see from inside. From the U.S. side, you look at the Mexican side and you see like graffiti saying like justice, no borders, right? This is the ugly U.S. side. I mean, it's all ugly, but you know, you get what I'm saying.
Are you the photographer?
We all took pictures. It's a combination of all of our pictures. since Chinga La Migra. This is an art memorial they made on the Mexican side. This is a U.S., what they call it, murder patrol, and then like chasing somebody and shooting somebody. This is more of this art. And then this is more like just messages and stuff like that. And there's, this one is a memorial of Jose Antonio Rodriguez, who was shot and killed by a Border Patrol officer. From the U.S. side, he shot the Mexican side and shot him in the back of the head. And then over here it says U.S. Murder Patrol. And on the right side, we saw this amazing graffiti that says Palestina Libre, Boycott Israel. More memorials for Jose Antonio. This is the AIPAC shelter that we visited in Mexico. We weren't really allowed to take pictures of people, so we just have pictures of the surroundings. It's a gated community, and they teach them how to farm, and they teach them English and other skills. So this is going to the desert with the Tucson Samaritans. So they use black jugs of water because the clear ones reflect light at night. And so when the helicopter is looking for water during the night, the clear ones reflect. So they use the black ones so it doesn't reflect light. Yeah. So this is one of our delegates, and this is one of the Tucson Samaritans, and this is a cross, and they planted it where human remains has been found. And then what they also use, the migrants, what they also use is they get carpets and they cut the carpets and they use it as the bottom of the shoe so it doesn't leave traces. So it's harder for U.S. Border Patrol to tail them. This is at the In Project shelter. The kids watching TV. This is clothes that they collect. And this is how they sleep. This is one of the shelters where ICE throws people off in the streets and they get picked up. This is one of many, many shelters that exist there. This is how the checkpoint looks. If you've been to Palestine, I think many of you in this room have been. We'll see how similar it is. This is just random. So they stop you and they ask you, is everybody in this car a citizen? And at some point they stopped the other half of the delegates. And she said, they asked the driver, who was a white woman, they asked her, are you and everyone here a citizen? And she said, yes, and we have a DACA recipient in the back. So the officer goes to the back and asks, can I see both of your IDs? There's a black woman and a Latina woman sitting in the back, and he asked them for their ID. So they pulled out an ID, and then the white woman who was driving, pulled out her ID as well and said, here's my ID. And then the patrol officer said, no, 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 you're good. I just want to check their IDs. Yeah. This is at Arivaca. This is what their mural is. Imagine peace and justice in the borderlands. This is the sign that says no militia. This is their office. And then this is in front of a bar. It says, unwanted members of any vigilante border militia groups are not welcome here or do not enter. And this is in front of their office. And this is, we weren't supposed to take pictures inside the courtroom, but if you see, this is one, two people who are part of this, the deportation machine, who are, they're now leaving the courtroom. This is the public defender that when she spoke to us, she was crying and she told us, I would rather do this than anybody else do this. And, you know, she felt guilty because she's getting government money, but she said, I'd rather me do it than anybody else. This is Mariposas Sin Fronteras. This is their house. It's where they host LGBT migrants and asylum seekers. And this is Arizona Palestine Solidarity Network. And that's it.
Can you get the lights?